Welcome, everyone, to our Thursday night Stargate Roundtable. We're happy to have all of you join us, and we're getting reports that we have people from, interestingly enough, from around the world. Omina has been telling me how many different countries and how many different places she's getting people to call in for readings. So it's interesting. We love to hear from you. If you want to email me, I'd always be happy to answer you and find out where you're all calling in from. So I'm Stargate Marietta, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, at Gmail. We'd love to hear from you. So as we begin, we always like to set the tone and get the energy started, and we have our dear Angel Sue that does that for us. So, Angel Sue, I pass the talking stick to you.
And I thank you very much. Oh, Marietta, your voice sounds really strong and clear tonight, and I find that to be a big blessing. And for all of you, we welcome you in the light of the Most Radiant One, in the office of the Christ, and only in the office of the Christ. And we're invoking the loving energies of Saint Germain and the Violet Flame. And if you will please, Stargate Roundtable people, will you please claim yourselves yet again as the beloved children of God, Goddess, all there is, the God of your heart. And just connect in with your higher self, your beloved twin flame, your guides, your masters, your teachers, your angels, your councils of light, and all the loving hearts from many, many dimensions that celebrate your path here on the earth. This is our work, to get ourselves clear and the vibrations changed, and then hold that energy for others that we are connected with, and then use the law of one, the original law of creation. So in our process of doing that, let's take that breathing process where we take in a breath for a count of 10, hold it for a count of 10, and then breathe out for a count of 10, and we'll do that 3 times. So I'm going to mute out so you can just get more centered and into that breath, and here we go. And now just allow your focus to go on the inside. It's just a quick look from the top of your head down to the bottom of your toes. And see what needs to be celebrated, what needs to be calibrated, what needs to be harmonized, what needs to be released. And just allow this process to go forward, holding those words of high frequency. I praise you. I respect you. I thank you. I love you. Or if you use another energy technique like Ho'oponopono, whatever, use that intent. Just find that balance and hold that energy. And allow things to just flow into their proper places. What can be released is just going to flow out through the bottom of your feet, right down into the center of Mother Earth. In the center, there is a beautiful cobalt blue sun. We're sending all that energy to be repurposed, and Mother Earth accepts it with gladness. There's no good, there's no bad. We're just recycling things, resetting things, and she sends it right back to you. energy that flows up out of the earth right behind you into a beautiful arc that is a twin arc, like wings, that comes in with each shoulder blade, that energy. And allow this to cycle and bless you with all of Mother Earth's love. Praise, respecting, thanking, and loving it all. And then connect with your intent with the great central sun. Allow that energy to flow up and connect. And more calibrations, more love, more attunements, more blessings. So as this power of light enfolds you, and the pillar flowing through you with the beautiful wing energy that you're receiving from Mother Earth, allow this to just start cycling as it will. Until your tube of light is so bright and you're feeling so centered with Earth and with the great central sun. Intend that this be flowing as long as you need it, perfecting whatever you need, directing, guarding, and protecting. And now, I wish to direct your intent into your memories where you have felt so wonderful, so loved, so at one met with the universe, something that you've enjoyed tremendously. And we're going to do the peace breath. You just take in a big, deep breath in. And on the out breath, somewhere, say the word peace. And let that wonderful memory of feeling good put a new spin and sink in even deeper. Peace. Let your body remember feeling good. Peace. Now, we've got a different frequency going. We've got the heart space flowing. Allow your awareness to go to the people you claim in your life, your family, your friends, your associates, to the white hats, even to the black hats, all those that you're aware of in the news. People and places and situations, all dimensions, all kingdoms. And we're just going to hold this energy of praise, respect, thanks, and love with divine neutrality. And so we're even going to spin the energies in for Nasara, the Reformation Act, our entire planet repurposing into celebrating the divine in everything, bringing forth heaven on earth. And with praise, respect, thanks, and love, we're allowing this energy to flow into everything throughout all time and space. Connecting in with these dear, beloved brothers and sisters in whatever condition they are. And with this intent of praise, respect, thanks, and love, we are also calling in the beings known and unknown, seen and unseen, to bring forth our Faction 3 White Knights energy blessing of Nasara, the Reformation Act, and all those that are bringing this to us. And we're calling on the law of one for the highest and the best blessings. So that's where we say we are all one. And when one is harmed, then all are harmed. As one is helped, then all are helped. And therefore, in the name of who we are, and we are one with all there is, we ask that only that which is the highest good of all concern to happen here, to have this beautiful healing, to have heaven for each and every being. And so with this, we intend that the avatars, the masters, the angels, all those energy workers that are working with us to bring forth heaven now, we're calling on them, and under the law of one for the highest good of all concern, keep it going and flowing, perfecting and ever evolving even into higher and better blessings than we can imagine. And with this, with joyful hearts, we say thank you. And thank you for doing such a beautiful job. And we love you. And with this, we're closing it down now by saying all men, all women, all children, all beings, all creation, we are all one. And Marita Robert, I pass the talking stick. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Angel Sue, for setting the tone and getting us started. And I'll pass the talking stick next to our dear Carolyn Little Rainbird and see what she has to share with us for the energies of the Mayan calendar for the week.
Well, thank you, Marita. I'll take that talking stick. Yes, the calendar looks good for this week. This is a six Lamont, and we're in the wave of off-ball. Okay, so what does that mean? The wave of off-ball is the wave of the night, and it's where we participate in our abundance and learn from the dream time and just embrace that protection of the night in our lives. So, and today being a six, a rhythmic tone, it's the tone of equality, it's the time to receive a responsibility, it's the test of opposites and represents the active receptivity of balance. So that's the nature of six. And we're Lamont with the Stargate, and so we're working with this energy or visionary aspect, the illumination of humankind, opening the Stargate and journeying is part of the gifts of the day, and having the power to see beyond the gate. So envision the Sarah as we see beyond the gate. Let's go see that gate. And so that's the energy today, the Stargate energy with the six. And then tomorrow we have a portal day, and it's a seven, the moon. And so we're working with that portal energy, the seven energy, and that resonance and fine-tuning, channeling, and that ability to move from source and back to matter, that midpoint, the top of the mountain. So with that powerful energy and the portal day and then the loop, and then working with our telepathy, the wise use of our rational mind, and accepting spirit directions are all flavors of that moon energy. It's an artist aspect. It reminds us that universal mind is our mind, and practice our telepathy is strong. It's definitely strong now. Now that we're all 5D, so there you go, hone in on that one on Friday with that portal energy, that multidimensional aspect as well. And then on Saturday, which is the 10-10, October 10th, in the calendar that we're using, legally. Yeah, I also had left hips then, so it's a good manifestation day. And the Mayan day is an 8 oak. So 8, getting that tone of fine-tuning, that harmonic resonance, and oak, the dog, that unconditional love of the dog. So let's fine-tune our unconditional love and manifest it for all of humanity. On Saturday. Very powerful day for manifestation and for unconditional love and fine-tuning our relationships with that love. So here we go on Saturday with that energy, and then on Sunday there's a new moon and a 9-2-ing. That 9 energy, there's expanded cycles, it's pulsation, it represents the power of action set into motion. And then the energy of chewing is balancing work and play in our lives. So let's do that with greater cycles and extend it. Expand that energy and set our intentions for this new moon with that intention of balancing our work and play. So there you go. That's Sunday, very powerful time for those moon energies. And then on Monday, another portal day. And it's a 10, so we're going to manifest on multidimensional realities on Monday. It's that 10 Eve, and it's that human servant warrior energy. The human is Eve. And it's a healing aspect. It's about the our job is the enlightenment of humankind and activating cosmic consciousness and attuning to spirit. So we do those things with the gift of being that human servant warrior and being in our abundance. So contact with other dimensions is important on this day as well. So enjoy Monday. It's very powerful. So let's manifest ourselves as sacred human beings on Monday. Tuesday, an 11 then. 11 is about letting go and disintegration, dissonance, change. And then the Skywalker, doing that journey, that warrior aspect, focusing, driving towards self-illumination and clarity in our lives. We have the gift of strength and that ability to bend dimensions. And so we have that way of letting go of what no longer serves us with that sacred tone of 11 at the same time. So let's work with that resistance to faith and letting go of that and work with our strength and ability to bend dimensions with letting go of what is in our way and what is blocking us.
Rainbird?
Yes.
You're real muffly. I don't know if maybe you could turn up your thing and maybe fix something.
It would be okay, sad. I'm sorry. Let me check that. Hold on. Oh, is this better?
That's a little better, yeah. Thank you.
I can turn it up a little more. Okay, and so we're on Wednesday with a 12 each, the Jaguar energy, the Magician energy, the Jaguar Priestess, I should say it that way, the Magician each, and 12, working with that energy, with that complex stability of that tone, very powerful tone, the crystal tone, it's called, and it's the about the unity of polarity. So there we go. We have our work cut out with us for us. But we have it with that good solar seal of Ish. So we can work with our magical powers, our visionary aspect, and the illumination for others, the clarity of mind and purpose with that tone of clarity. So Wednesday is a good day. And Thursday, when we come back, we complete this wave that we're in of Akbal with a 13 men, that visionary, the eagle energy, and that 13 transcendence. And, yeah, taking it to the next level, that cosmic level of energy. So there we go. That's a powerful week. And remember, Friday, tomorrow is a portal day. That Monday is a portal day. We're working with the new moon on Sunday and the 10-10-10 on Saturday. So we have a lot to look forward to and a lot of support from the universe for the work that we do. Thank you for all of your lives and for all that you do. And I pass this talking stick right back to you, Marita. Here it comes.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. We appreciate all of what you do, and make sure that you let us know if you have anything for your classes that you need to announce.
Oh, yes, I do, as a matter of fact. This Sunday, I'm having just a little call at 3 o'clock with the students who have taken the Universal Energy Healing, and just a gathering for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, to discuss things or just read material or whatever comes up. And I don't have that phone number right in front of me. So
well, if you want to get it and then come back, we can, Helen's okay. Going to make a short announcement. You can, if you want to get it and come back on after that, we can do that.
Okay. Yeah, that'll work. Okay. Thanks. All right. Thanks for talking to
you. Rainbird and Marita, I can give it right now. I got it right in front of me.
Okay, good.
It's 712-775-7031. And the PIN is 767-772-364 pound. I better say that
again. Why don't you do it again, just to make sure everybody got it?
Okay. Okay. There's lots of sevens, that's for sure. 712-775-7031. And the PIN is 767-722-364 pound.
Now I had something different the first time. I had another seven and you said two twos this time. So the PIN number, do the PIN number for me again.
767-722-364 pound.
Okay. I had
two
extra sevens in there the first time, and that's where.
Oh.
Okay. Well, we thank you, is that at 3 o'clock on Sunday?
3 o'clock Eastern, yes.
Okay. All right. We have Helen Andrasco ask if she could make an announcement here this evening about a book that she has available. So, BBS, can you plug Helen in so that she can hear us and we can hear her?
I'm online. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, in the end of February, I finally published the black and white copy of the Psalms, because the colored version was very expensive. So we took the color out and reprinted it in the fourth edition, and it's $12.99, a far cry from $36.94. And I'm getting, I've only sold half a dozen copies, but I'm getting very good reports from it. And so I would like to let it be known that the Psalms of Aquarius by Helen Andrasco, with the preface by Archbishop Bernard Gorman of an international metaphysical church, is on press with very good reviews so far. In fact, I was sent one of the reviews to okay by the person that wrote it. They got in touch with me, and they said, is this okay? Can I write this? She told me she found the book to be written, she said, to me, it's a quest. It's a quest for my own divine nature. And I wanted to see if what I said in the review that I'm going to put on is okay with you. Usually people don't do that. But anyway, I would like to read the review, if I may, that she sent me for my approval. It's in the Psalms of Aquarius. Helen Andreasco has delivered a story rich with meaning and layered in spiritual wisdom of the soul's journey, reaching for a greater expression of itself. For anyone interested in an intimate relationship with divine guidance, this book is a joyful and fulfilling treasure. Opening any page reveals, through poetic beauty, images that stir the heart to awaken and the mind to expand beyond its limited understanding. The three sections speak to the movement of the soul rising to reclaim the higher indwelling divine nature of love blending with power, and of the arrival of this new time built on the foundations of peace. As the sacred messages come through, they bring the greater truths to heal and inspire an ongoing expansion of consciousness, freeing the mind to sweep clear outmoded ideas and ways of being. Helen invites us to use the Psalms as a personal learning tool to adjust to the incoming higher vibrations, to shake off the old way of thinking, speaking, doing, and being, and so enjoy the return to eternal joys forever. Used as a manual, the print is easy to read, with spaces and pages left open for readers to make notes. There is also a guide to the Psalm keywords as a help in searching for important topics in the Psalms. Signed, Melody Balkenis, Doctor of Chiropractic. I don't know how many people get a review before it's put on. I was tremendously grateful to receive this, because I feel that's how I feel about the book. Wrote it, and I'm told not to say channel, so I have to catch myself. When I wrote the book, I thought, well, this is something beyond me, and I'm very in awe at some of the writings that's in the book.
So Helen, let me interrupt you here. The first word is Psalms, P-S-A-L-M-S, Psalms,
right,
of Aquarius. And people can find this on Amazon?
Right. But I suggest underneath the write-up, it has a place for Create Space. Now, Create Space is the one that is publishing it, and they have to sell it to Amazon. So for quicker delivery, if they go to www.createspace, no space in between, one word, .com/5748392, that you'll bring it up to the book. And the delivery should be a lot sooner than from Amazon.
Okay. Well, we thank you for sharing that information with us. And is the color book still available if someone wants that, or are you only doing black and white now?
Well, no, both the books are available. They want me to charge $56 for the book that I they put in for $36, but I'm not going to do it. I mean, the money is not the thing. You know, to me, the message is far more important than making a couple extra dollars.
So the black and white then is $12.99?
Right.
Okay.
$12.99. It's the same thing, except the third version, the third revised version, is $36.94 in color, very beautiful. And the black and white version, which has the color on the cover only, is $12.99. And I'm very happy to have this. Everything is the same, but the black and white version is the fourth edition.
All right. Well, we thank you for sharing all of that with us, and we hope that we know that the people that need to see this will hear it and take some action. So we allow spirit to work with however it needs to be done. And thank you for coming on.
Thank you so
and
much
I will pass the talking stick next to Tara and Rama. Rama, we want to know who you talk to out there today.
Okay. Rama lost his voice again, everybody. So listen real carefully, and I'll stuff it right close to his mouth. Hopefully you can hear.
Okay.
Hello, everybody. I'm not Mother. This is Rama.
Okay.
I got to talk with Tom the Cat today, and there is a whole heaven of a lot going on the planet. And it's all got to do with the change of everything right in the moment. And Tom the Cat said to me that in the last 4 days, Russia struck 12 targets in Syria.
12 ISIL targets.
Yeah. And then I saw on the news this evening, two of the missiles landed in Iran.
Yes, right at the border.
Yeah.
But Russia denies that remark, and you've got to double check with your people, because I'll tell you what, NATO is salivating to go after Russia.
Yeah.
And that is not a good idea.
No, and they are talking about sending NATO troops to Turkey.
Sending NATO troops to Turkey.
Yeah.
Where is your father?
On the bridge.
I mean, all the innocent civilians that are dying, I don't even know how many. It's just absolutely a nightmare. And what Tom, what you told me Tom said is that how come in 4 days, you know, Russia practically took all of ISIL's, you know, out, and it's been 13 months for the United States.
And you know the reason why.
Because we are backing ISIL, and we don't want to knock them out. We want to just keep on drolling and droning around and find out some reason to go to a bigger war game.
Yes.
Well, that's the other thing that I keep hearing on when you're looking at the news on public television and that kind of thing, they keep saying that Russia is not hitting ISIS, that they are going after all those that are supporting the dictator that they have there. Is that true?
What, Rama?
What she was saying is that, could you repeat that, Marita?
Okay, what I'm hearing is that they're suggesting that Russia is not hitting the ice spots.
Yeah,
that he's hitting the ones who are supporting the dictator that is there, because he does not like him.
Okay, now wait a minute. What dictator? I mean,
Mr. Assad.
No, Russia likes Assad.
I know.
But Russia's been, far as I know, Russia's been, when they first started on the first day, they were targeting the Syrian rebels. And that's something we're backing too.
Yes.
And Russia knows that. And the other one was the, what's it called?
Al-Nusra.
Al-Nusra. That's another one that's kind of doesn't like Assad.
Right.
And the platform that Russia's been holding all along, I mean, they want Paul Ryan to run for speaker now that McCarthy jumped bail. What I heard is that McCarthy can't decide whether he's going to keep his majority position or not. Not after what he did, plus Alan Greenspan. I'm jumping to another subject. Alan Greenspan, he filed ethics charges against...
Not Alan Greenspan.
I mean, Alan...
Grayson.
Grayson, excuse me, from Florida, the Democrat. Big difference. Excuse me, my
Blaze
brain.
The violet fire.
He filed ethics charges against Gowdy, Trey Gowdy, who's the chair at the email hearings against Hillary,
yeah,
and McCarthy, Kevin McCarthy, for using, by their own admission, for using that setup to actually gain political advantage over Hillary. And that's against the law, and it's a crime, of an ethics crime, and they cannot do that. So he doesn't really have a right to say he's going to keep his majority position because of that question mark. He needs to step down, and somebody else needs to take that position. And on top of that, I mean, Tom was indicating that Nancy Pelosi most likely will get that gavel. You know, it'll go from Boehner to back to Nancy because of this questionable situation. And it's not just questionable for this one guy. Every single Republican, the whole party's in question as to whether or not it belongs here.
Yeah, on Chris Hayes tonight, they were talking and saying that there were many Republicans crying in the coat room.
Oh yeah, they were very, very upset. And see, the Tea Party is really a problem
all the way around.
And
I'll bring it back to the story.
Yeah, back to the other story. Go ahead.
Yeah. Tom the Cat said there are so many good things coming forward right at this time, even though we are looking at such horrendous things going on across the planet. Dr. Keshe has just released a new device between the 24th, 23rd of September and October 1st. This is a device that is $200 or less, and you can power your house with it and never have to give the utility company another penny.
So what's the difference between the one he first put out for $750 that does the same thing and this one's only $200? How did that happen?
I don't know enough. I gotta watch the video. That's 3 hours long.
Oh.
Yeah.
There's one that's 3 hours plus long and there's another one 2 hours plus long.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to have to kind of listen, but this is the first time he's put anything out since last June, May.
This is a big deal, and October 16th, he is supposed to talk about something humongous. That's the way it's being described.
I'm just going to say that there's, you know, the chemistry award came out, and there was two United States people.
Yeah.
And one person from the UK, and they figured out how the cell regenerates the DNA. I mean, it's just like it's over the top what they figured, because they pretty much know then how to cancel out all cancers.
Basically. This is going into the quantum field, talking about the neutrinos and the particles.
Yeah, and I think you should send an email and send this stuff and say, your comments not seen.
Yeah.
Because they're basically saying that all the physicists have been wrong.
That's right.
And the chemists. There was the physicists won the day before. I forgot what that was about.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say that basically we don't need the fossil fuel energy ever again.
No.
Everything is based on, you know, all these illnesses, all these cancers are because of what we've done to our atmosphere going over to the fossil fuel system when back 100 and some years ago we didn't even need to do it then.
In the video, in the beginning, no. Dr. Keshe shows this power strip that looks like a multi-plug power strip that you plug 4 or 5 plugs into. And one is for your laptop, one is for
your TV,
one is for other things.
Your telephone recorder.
Yeah.
Whatever else you need. But, I mean, 5 isn't enough because people got their, what, they got their washer, their dryer. You got to get another 5 and another 5, however many things people got, saws, everything.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, I mean, when we look at the larger picture, you're talking about, you know, everything we've been told is not right. Last week when we had Brent Courtright on, he was talking about the fact that they've now proved that, you know, they've always said that the human brain doesn't continue to regenerate and rebuild itself after, you know, that the 20s, and it's just a downhill process. And he was saying we now know that the neurogenesis, the reproductive part of it, continues throughout your life. So
yes.
I mean, it's like each week we're getting more and more information about the stuff that we've been told. It's like an unraveling of the story that was written not by the truth seekers and the truth bearers, but those that wanted to control people. And those things are being unraveled. And, you know, each week we get a little more information about that.
Yes. And also, Tom the Cat shared with me that E.T. Corey put out a new story in the last couple weeks talking how he met with 7 members of the Inner Earth Cities. And some of it in the story is a bit convoluted.
Yeah, they don't want to admit that there's a fifth dimension, etheric physical dimension to that underground base. They don't want to admit that.
Yes. He talked about how the Agarthan, the people of Agartha, made deals with the Nazis and some of the not so nice surface people. And I would just say I would not put the full blame on the Agarthan network. It has to do with many other civilizations that were coming in right before the destruction of Atlantis, right before the destruction of Lemuria. It is a very convoluted story. I was there, an eyewitness. So there's many facets to the story. He's getting some of the pieces correct, some of it maybe isn't exactly correct because it doesn't exactly speak to Ashtar like I do, or the Ashtar Command. I don't know where to go with this story, except I am going to talk to some more folks in the Faction 3 to find out the real story about this. I passed the talking stick.
I see there was a gas explosion in Louisiana.
Yes.
And then there's another story. There's like tens of millions of gallons of water lost every single day because the water system in Louisiana and all the pipes are corroded. And I mean, it's just a mess. And that's not the only place that this is true. And that goes together with a couple of days ago up there in Flint, Michigan. They a couple of years ago, they switched their water system out of Detroit, and they went to the Flint River. And the Flint River is like 15 times over the maximum limit of lead that you can have in anything you're drinking. All the kids are getting real high readings of lead in their systems. And there's all kinds of trouble that comes from that. And so they're trying to, you know, lobby for going back to the Detroit water system. And I'm just going to say there's just so much. These guys are completely locked in, and they don't want to give up their story, you know, tell the truth about what they've been doing. And it's, you know, they've been robbing robbing Peter to pay Paul, you know. They're not Peter Pan either. It's just the opposite. And then I hear that what's her name, the Federal Reserve Bank, Janet Yellen, is going to raise the interest rates. The last time she started to do this, she ended up in the hospital from high blood pressure or hypertension or something. And now they want her to do it again. And what did Tom say about that?
That's going to push the entire fake money system over the edge.
Yeah.
And you all know, you know, I have to wonder why she had that the last time, whether it was a natural occurrence or whether it was beamed to her.
That's right.
Well, yeah, but now she's doing it again. So how come she didn't get in the hospital again?
Maybe.
I just don't know what's going on there. You know for sure that everybody behind this behind the scenes are trying to actually out each other to the point of killing each other. It's absolutely that far gone. The other thing is that Tom Hartman was just, you know, he was surmising some things, and he was saying, well, what as we use the TPP, because, you know, United States, in the next 2 weeks, we're hearing that the United States is going to take their warships into the South China Sea and go after China. And, you know, well, I'm sure they're going to put theirs out. This is not a good idea.
No, it's not.
Yet what's going on is that, you know, China's taken, you know, Earth, and they've built up and made these fake islands, and they are adjacent to the Spratlys. And that turf has been claimed to be national waters and was, you know, and China's saying that that's theirs from old times or whatever. Anyway, there's a big old hoopla about that. And so they don't want to let anybody come into that area, including in the air and on the sea, which is dealing with United States planes in the air and our ships in the sea and Vietnam's and Malaysia and Indonesia and all these other continental countries off that same area, and Japan and Philippines, all that stuff. And they are building up and making these fake little islands, and then they're building military airstrips. They've got three of them, and they're doing more stuff. It's not pretty, and they're claiming it's China's, and everybody else has to stay out. There's always an economic, political, and, you know, war is connected to those two other fields. So this TPP, since China's not a member, they're saying down the road it would be, what could be done is that the Western countries could agree to pull all of their stuff out of China that's being built in China. Our 65,000 factories went over there. Take them all out of there and put them in these other countries like Vietnam and Indonesia and Malaysia, and boost up the amount that gets paid and give those people some good jobs. And then, you know, take China down economically for what they have been doing. And it's all very, it's time for, you know, getting back to a whole thing called, I mean, Democracy Got Lost. I mean, that song, Democracy Is Coming to the USA, ain't made it yet. by Cohen. What's his first name? Leonard Cohen, right. I'm just going to say a lot of these things are very, very tenuously scary. And tonight we're going to play a half hour of special conversations with great minds where this gentleman is going to be speaking about how climate change has interfaced with these Syrian situations, you know, because evidently they had more than we ever knew. Like 4 years is nothing. It's 5.5, almost 6 years from 2005 to the end of 2011. They had massive, massive droughts. And then from 1971 to 2010, Syria had dramatic precipitation changes all through that period. And the governings, and I know that Syria has been governed in the same inbred family all through that time, all the way back to the 30s, to be honest with you. Assad's just the tail end of this. It's been unilaterally controlled by, you know, this inbred family. A certain type of
Alawites,
that's right. We read about that a long time ago, but anyway, what they were doing, and they weren't using any sensibilities at all, because what they were doing is they were growing cotton and wheat during those periods, and both of those crops are super water intensive in terms of what's needed to grow those products. And I know that there could be alternatives. Hemp needs like at least 10 times less water, and it can be made into clothes.
Also,
in a better way. What?
Bear in mind also, they were spraying the evil fairy dust over Syria too.
Oh yeah, that's been global. Yeah. That's the chemtrails have been being sprayed on a global scale, which has altered the weather dramatically. It also works because you know how it films and then it blots out the sun, and then you can't see the ships in the sky either. So they've been using it as a dual purpose, plus, you know, poisoning our land and our bodies and everything else, altering our DNA. I mean, it's not a good scene. But anyway, so there's much to look at and to comprehend about, you know, even China has been in climatic shock for decades.
Yeah.
And yes.
Tara, I just had not had an answer here, and now they're saying they are calling Michael because I had not had a response to that. So hopefully he's going to be on the line here shortly. So just heads up.
Okay. Okay, and then Japan and Russia have been meeting for peace treaty talks, and Japan's senior diplomat is reuniting and restarting some stalled peace talks with Russia. And one of the major topics is there's some islands, some Russian islands up north that Japan says were intrinsically theirs, and it wasn't all right for after World War II for Russia to just take them over as if they were there. And Russia had agreed to discuss that with them. So let's put that in the circle of support. And the supervisor of the United States airstrike on the hospital in Afghanistan describes a survivor describes the chaos from that bombing and makes it extremely clear that they were fully called and informed a half an hour into the bombing that they needed to stop because this was a designated hospital that needed not one more you know, bomb being dropped on it, and they persisted for a full half hour afterwards. So this is not okay just to have a forgiveness thing. There's going to be some things to pay for that. So I think Michael's here with us now, so I'll pass this talking stick back to you, Sister Marita.
You. Well, Michael, can you hear us, and are you with us?
I'm here.
How well, good. Well, Michael King is our guest tonight. He's not a stranger on this program. We've had him many times, and he wears many different hats. He has wonderful herbs, but then he also has presented a lot of very wonderful spiritual attitudes and ideas. And so we'll what do you have? I know you've been changing some of your herbal things. Do you have anything there that you want to mention this evening, or are you going a totally different direction?
I'm open. I was hoping actually to do a Q&A for part of this.
Okay.
For this, only because there's so often, you know, I rattle on until the end, and we don't have time for Q&A. So I'm interested in hearing feedback from people or questions that you may have. And specifically with respect to the last call, I wanted to know if there was anyone who was on that last call that I was speaking on that that had utilized the inner healing method, and if they had any comments or experiences or feedback that they with respect to that. Otherwise, I'm also open to any other subject that comes up. So leave the floor
okay.
Open if anybody wants
well,
to.
Well, I'll go ahead and give the 800 number that people can call in. It's free for the United States and Canada. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. So go ahead, Michael, and then if we get some people calling in, I'll let you know.
Okay, so real quick, let's talk about some changes in the clay world.
Mm-hmm.
We are really we've gone round and round with respect to clay varieties and finding new sources of clay because we have had a problem with supply, and so. So it happens that we lost access to our original sacred clay supply source, and we have a little bit that's able to be used for bath purposes that's dwindling as well, but it's not suitable because of the way it was stored for internal use. We basically scoured the whole region where this clay is found and located right next to our Ormolite mine. We own that deposit, and we found this clay that's now called Aquaterra. And it is mostly a kaolinite clay with other characteristics that are very similar to the pyrophyllite, or what we have considered to be pyrophyllite in the past, according to a 1980s geological report. Today we question that, and we're not real clear just what it is, but it's mostly an illite, rectorite-type clay. Both of them are, with the exception of the kaolinite, which is in both, but also just a larger percentage in the Aquaterra. So we'll be coming out with more specific analyses over time on both of these. But nevertheless, what it means is, the sacred clay has always held a special power, a special interest in vibrancy, electrical energy. And so when we found a source next to the Ormolite mine, which is about 8 miles away from the sacred clay mine, that we, 8 to 15, that we, no, it's 8 miles away from sacred clay, 15 from Crater Lake, I believe, is how it works. I've actually forgotten the stats on that, but nevertheless, it's the idea is they're close, and so they're likely formed in a similar geological period for same reasons. underground aquifer water, steam and pressure have formed or been involved in the transformation of lava into clay on both cases. In the with respect to Aquaterra, it's laced in various degrees with ormolite because it's right there, so right next to each other. And it's just thin.
So, Michael, let me interrupt you just a moment. Those people, you know, I know we have a lot of people on the call that are here every week and have been here for a long time. I also am aware recently from reports that I'm getting that we have a lot of new people, and they're not all here in the States even. So can you briefly talk about what the value of the clay is or why we would want to use this, just for those that have no background or no basis foundation to lay this information on?
Oh, good. Okay, thank you for pointing that out. So for the new people, you can, while we're talking here, you could go to our website and it'll sort of begin the introduction. I'll give you an overview. It's vitalityherbsandclay.com. So that's V-I-T-A-L-I-T-Y, herbs, plural, A-N-D, clay.com. And the articles on clay is listed right up at the top there. So, but basically, we believe in eating dirt and bathing in dirt, exposing ourselves to, you know, using clay packs and a variety of uses for clay, some of which have enlightening effects. If there's ormous qualities in this volcanic material broken down into clay, if there's you have, you know, endocrine system enhancers because minerals are the basis of hormone production, you have harmonization of the whole meridian field of the body when you consume some of the ormous clays. Ormolite and vitalite are the two major ormous clays. Aquaterra has a small portion of that in it. Sacred clay has an even smaller portion of it naturally occurring. So sacred clay was our dominant clay for bath and internal use. Then the owner of that deposit decided to sell it mostly for to the pig farmers, and because it has you know, pretty effective antibacterial properties proven by the University of Arizona State University. So they started using it for that. Thought figured they could get more money than selling it to us. So that left us without a source, and so we began scouring the neighborhood for a new source. We landed upon Aquaterra, very close to our ormolite, ormus-type product. Well, ormus is a monatomic, so it's some people have related that to the Philosopher's Stone. Some recent reports indicate that Philosopher's Stones was more about enlightenment than actual ormus. But ormus lends you to greater states of awareness. It opens up your intuitive centers. It feeds your hormonal system, specifically the pineal gland. And specifically, it opens up the heart. So you really have, you know, what nature has created when you have this ormus property, which is single atom monoatomic elements of mostly the platinum group, but other minerals as well, then you have something of a superconductor quality, and it reacts with your nervous system and your hormonal system in a very beneficial kind of way. So we've capitalized on that, explored it in various ways, and began filed mining claim and began to excavate that. So it's taken a while to really understand it, but we have a lot of information on the website about the ormolite and the vitalite in article form. But then the sacred clay has always been the primary clay. And because it has such powerful bonding capacities, it's got a lot of electrolytes, so it's a very small particle size, so it bonds readily with toxins, heavy metals, chemicals and so forth, so much so that when one auto mechanic, 10-year auto mechanic, took his first clay bath, he found an eighth of an inch of an oil slick on the bottom of his tub.
Wow.
Vietnam vet, many years in the military, experimenting on heavily with chemicals in the military, etc., very sick, takes his first clay bath. The water turns black in 5 minutes. That's rare. I don't want to say everyone would experience that I can hardly count on two hands the number of people who actually notice changes in the water. But but when you have heavy chemical toxicity, these things are possible because the power of the clay draws this stuff out. And so you can imagine because we're exposed to radiation, heavy metals continuously, on a regular basis, you can imagine how powerful or how beneficial it could be to be consuming something that goes in, cleans out, debris in the gut, absorbs toxic material in the body, out of the blood, supports hormone production because that's what minerals do. They help feed the hormonal system of the body. And every metabolic process from DNA transformation into amino acids and from amino acids to proteins, it's all based originally on mineral constructs, minerals, hydrogen and oxygen primarily. So for all those reasons, minerals are at the basis of human life. The bodies were made of the dust of the earth or the clay of the earth. So those minerals are critical to as a food source, as a medicinal source. So they're very helpful in numerous ways. And so we paid a lot of attention to this. And so now, my habit is to eat between 1 and 2 tablespoons of various mineral sources, always a full spectrum source made from nature. I'll eat that per day.
And Michael, to throw this in, I have some friends or acquaintances who, and of course, Robert always was a big proponent of using the minerals. And what I want to say about other people that talk to me, they say, they're so concerned about getting too much or getting toxic or overdosing on the minerals. Can you address that so that people are not in such fear about using minerals? It seems that I don't know whether that's come from the medical world, because, if you tell a doctor you're doing this, they get all excited about it because they think maybe that's what they've been taught in medical school. I don't know where it comes from, but there seems to be feedback to me about, be really careful with the minerals. I mean, you could really get in trouble using those. Well, probably not near as much trouble as using the drugs that are out there. But can you speak a little bit about that, why it's not such a problem as people think it is?
Absolutely. And that's a really good point, good question, because it comes up all the time, and rightfully so. It's understandable why it comes up. Bottom line is, if nature made it, you have to use discretion, but in more often than not, it's going to be in its right use and its right proportion, quantity, that it's extremely helpful because nature created it. So we're talking seaweeds, algae, herbs, clays, humic acids, things like that that are straight from nature. If you talk about industry, or you talk about the vitamin industry and the mineral, vitamin mineral industry, and so you get these multivitamins, and you look on the bottle, and the ingredients are not so many milligrams of alfalfa, so much of nettles, so much of this herb or that clay. It's so much calcium, so much magnesium, so much zinc, and so much ABCD, whatever vitamins. So that's where mankind has gone in error. And this is the reason why over 800 and some thousand people every year are killed, and many, many hundreds of thousands more maimed by medical treatment every year. So they are the second leading cause of death, the first being sugar, by the way. Concentrated sweeteners of all kinds are the number one degradation, no, cause of degraded health. They are the supportive cause, not always the original cause, but they are always supportive of decline in health. It's all concentrated sugars, natural or otherwise. And so, because they feed pathogens primarily, and they weaken the hormonal system of the body, and they black out a lot of, you know, your ability to concentrate, etc. So, but the medical profession obviously has taken its major toll and does every year for obvious reasons. These are just stats that are realistic and very based on an extensive amount of research. So, when you come and you take a vitamin formula that has lots of calcium, even if it's balanced with magnesium, or you do the CalMag thing, then you're messing up your mineral profiles because it doesn't have the other 90 minerals that need to go together if you want perfect balance. So you're, by only having two or one or 10, you're likely to throw off your mineral profiles because they are totally interdependent. Now, Mother Nature, when she makes a leaf, she knows how to put minerals in there along with vitamins, along with compounds, nutritional compounds unique to that plant, and like a lettuce or something. It's unique, and they have, you know, 20, 30, 50, 100 nutritional compounds of a variety of things, very well-balanced, orchestrated by natural law. To break those laws and say, oh, let me take the A out of the carrot and the C out of the orange and the calcium out of this rock, and let's throw it into a capsule and say, hey, here's your medicine, here's your food. The logic behind that has escaped me. And why we continue to believe that that's okay, because somebody wrote this article saying research says calcium is good for you for this reason. Do you realize if you take too much pure calcium, you will cause a heart attack? And the reason is because calcium by itself, without a proper balance of potassium, magnesium, and all the complementing minerals that support all three of those, which could be a total of 20 or 30 at least that we know of, maybe more that we don't know, that if you don't have that full spectrum balance that you'll only find in a naturally occurring product, like a clay or a good quality mineral source, a plant mineral source like a seaweed or algae, or humic acid or something like that, that nature created, then you're likely to get these excesses, and that's when a mineral can be dangerous. They've done studies to show that if you do a calcium supplement for a period of 5 years, you increase your risk of heart attack, strokes, and sudden death by 40% by taking a calcium supplement. So I wouldn't say that taking minerals are not dangerous. They can be dangerous if you're doing non-natural things that were not developed specifically by nature, that we have altered it. We have destroyed its original balance, and we have extracted this and that out of it and thrown it together in some so-called scientific way and tried to call that food and medicine, and it's not. So it's because calcium is used by the body to contract muscles. Magnesium is used to relax muscles. So if you have an overabundance of calcium, which you can also get an overabundance of calcium from lots of sunlight, which generates a lot of vitamin D in the body, which causes calcium to assimilate into your bones in different places. So you get bioavailable calcium getting in great abundance when you have cheese, milk, high calcium sources, and calcium supplements. And now you get this, not only do you get the calcium assimilation from the sun, but you also get it from the cheeses and so forth, and then you get this overabundance, and what happens? You get cramps because you got so much calcium, your muscles are tensing up, and then you stretch a little bit, and pretty soon they can't relax because they've used up or they've over-proportioned the magnesium that is used to relax, or they've made it unavailable. And so that's one of the major causes of cramps, is too much of a good thing, too much calcium. That's why I don't advocate taking calcium supplements at all. And even really some of these calcium-rich clays, while they're going to be safer than a mineral supplement that is not whole, like a clay would be, like the living clay and the calcium montmorillonites, calcium bentonites, these, generally they're good clays. I mean, I'm a fan of all clays. However, in this world, we are so calcium-prone and so calcium-abundant that we're getting too much. And you take a calcium-dominant clay source, and you're likely to get even too much more. So it's all about...
Michael, I know we talk about the seaweed and all the... algae and those things, knowing now that we have all the Fukushima and all these other kinds of things, I hear people talking about now attempting to grow the greens in a controlled environment because of the contamination. What's your view about all of that?
Okay, that's a pretty good question, because in this day and age, we have such a unique set of conditions, from the excessive amounts of toxicities and the amounts of radiation and so forth, that and there are so many foods that are no longer grown properly, so we don't really get nutrition from them as much. And so some foods are very harmful, and now they're genetically modified, so that eliminates a whole set of food groups. So we're in a different kind of world. So in some cases, what we have to do is just do the best we can, understanding it will never be good enough. So in that case, if we have to grow things indoors, that's not going to be as powerful as, say, a wildcrafted, something from the ocean. It won't be, but it can be still beneficial. It will still carry a lot of wonderful properties in it, and it's a controlled environment, so you're sure about the toxic levels. Now, there's something to be said along those lines, however. Seaweeds in the ocean and the algae in the ocean are part of the way the ocean keeps itself clean. And it doesn't mean that these seaweeds and algae get toxic. They can if they get overloaded. It's sort of like, if you have a sponge and you fill it, excessively with water, it's going to overflow, right? But if you just wiping up a spill and it's within the sponge's capacity, it doesn't really affect it. You squeeze it out and the sponge is okay, right? Well, in a seaweed or an algae, they use minerals and various nutritional compounds inside their bodies, so to speak, and they will attach to heavy metals, radiation, and so forth, and neutralize it. They change it. They bond with it. So radiation can be neutralized. Salt is a great neutralizer. Salt in the ocean, seaweeds, algae, and so forth. So there's microbes that consume radiation. That's one of their functions in nature. Now, science knows all about this. You don't hear anybody utilizing those things, and they might be utilizing them and just not wanting people to know. But you can neutralize radiation with microbes. You can neutralize it with clay. I did hear one report. They were putting zeolite in the river opening where Fukushima water was entering the ocean. They used clays in Chernobyl. They fed clay to the people, to the animals, to reduce radiation counts in their muscles before they slaughtered them, to give them within limits. What I'm saying is clays do have the ability. They know that when radiation falls from the atmosphere and enters the ground, that its radioactivity diminishes drastically because it interacts with the soil. The soil bonds with the radiation in various ways. Now, overabundance, like if you have, if you're getting a clay out of Nevada or New Mexico where they're doing underground nuclear testing, now you have this overabundance. It's something that's unnatural. It's concentrated. Again, just like a concentrated sugar, concentrated radiation is very harmful. Very, very mild amounts of radiation are very helpful. So it's really about proportion and sticking with the natural order. But even then, you know, some plants are poisonous. So you have to be, there's wisdom to be utilized in all cases. And that's why everyone needs a very refined sense of intuition. Because what would happen if you come, if you're brand new to a planet, and you come on, you see all these plants you've never seen before, and how are you going to know? Part of that, if you are advanced in your intuitive cycles, you can feel, you can commune with the plant, you can get to know what its purposes are, and all of that. Well, we've lost a lot of that over time, and so you know we're using the ancient manuals, and we're learning from people with lots of experience, and people who, you know, the experience of people who died eating certain plants and foods, or too much of this or that. And so we have a vast array of knowledge to draw from already, and enough to save this planet if we ever wanted to apply it. It's all about the will to change and will to promote the common good. So if you want to take care of yourself, these seaweeds and algae that have come from, say, the west coast of America, or some places like in the South Asian oceans, there is a great possibility that they're still safe, that if there was radiation contamination, that they've neutralized it in themselves, and it ceases to be that way. There's that possibility. It would need to be tested, because we not only have Fukushima, which is actually probably not nearly as abundant over here as what our own nuclear power plants are doing to our own waters. They're using Fukushima as an excuse. And why do we have Halliburton dumping cesium radiation off the southern coast of California? And blaming it on Fukushima. So I'm just saying that these things happen. And so we have to be aware that we're in a different environment than used to be 200 years ago. And we have a lot of self-interest in our government. And so that's why things are getting chaotic, and that's why things are going to get better. But we have to use discretion in the meanwhile. So we try to do the best we can with what we have. Test the water, so to speak. Test the source, and then feel your intuition. You know, you can know when you pick something up. Is it good for you? It gives you a depressant feeling or an uplifting feeling. And you can pose that question: is it uplifting or is it depressing? Well, once you become familiar with that, if you are not already, then you can test whether or not something's good for you. And I'm not talking specifically about muscle testing. I'm referring to, because that's a science that most people would not be able to get accurate answers from. There's way too much to it. I learned that from my sister, who's been in it for 35, 40 years. And you just can't get an accurate answer unless you really know what you're doing. So there is an intuitive insight, an intuitive knowing that I rely upon in order to get my answers and derive it from various sources of life that have very, very knowledgeable insights, you know, a big bank of knowledge, you could say, that is different from just the body. You never want to just ask the body. You need to ask of higher sources, higher banks of knowledge than the body, and the body will respond just as easily. So when you're doing testing like this. We have to do the best we can, and I would say in our world, in our business, you know, I have the herbs, the clays, everything, because I sought from Mother Nature an answer that says, I wanted to know what was the best of the best that nature had to offer. My trust was in nature. I knew that this was the way to go. Back in the early 80s, I was in severe state of depletion, severe exhaustion, major fungal overgrowth, a big sugar user, junk foodist, and I was pretty sick, a lot of health problems. I was 2 years antibiotics in high school, cleaned my clock. I had virtually lost my capacity for memory during college years, barely graduated, almost flunked out. Chronic fatigue upon graduation, and then started seeking in the early 80s, actually in 76, the natural health world sort of opened up, and in the early 80s, the herbs. And once I found the herbs, for the first time in my entire life, I felt normal when I took enough of an adaptogenic formula, Chinese formula with lots of adaptogens in it. Adaptogens are special herbs that balance your hormonal levels no matter if you're high or low. So they adapt you to your stresses. So I took a large, large amount of those, and for the first time, my head cleared up, my emotions, everything straightened out, everything felt different. I felt normal for the first time ever in my life. And that's what turned my head and said, nature has the answers. And I've never gone back since. Herbs have been a big part of my life. So this company was sort of an outgrowth because I couldn't find out there what I really wanted in terms of quality, comprehensiveness, strictly, you know, nature made, not these extracts and isolates and so forth of the natural health world. And I didn't know much about diet. That I had learned through a lot of more School of Hard Knocks lessons to understand food combining and so forth. So all of this happened over since 1976 as a result of very poor health, being, you know, birthed in that way from parents who had poor health. And, you know, so I dealt with all that for good reason. So this company is an outgrowth of that. I made it for myself, and other people wanted it, so we had to start making it more of it. And that's really how it developed, and still is. So we don't advertise. We only go word of mouth, and it just grows. So it is what it is. We have to make the best of it. So this food source that we have put together is the best that we know how to put together to feed our bodies maximum nutrition, to detoxify this ongoing onslaught of toxins, to rebuild weakened systems from, you know, our sugar use, our bad diet, our toxic overloads that weaken certain organs and glands, overwhelms the liver, stresses the kidneys, you know, all of this impact upon the body because of our environment and our diet, etc., and attitudes, beliefs, worry, stress, you know, all that, lifestyle. And so these impact the body. And so we have to rebuild the weakened systems. The digestive system gets weakened from antibiotics, etc. The immune system gets weakened from the sugar. Splenic is the lymphatic system that's weakened by sugar stimulants and alcohol. So the bowels are just congested because of junk food and etc. And not enough probiotics from because they've been killed off by the antibiotics. So this is the life that we live. So correcting all of that is best done with Mother Nature's sources rather than a laboratory's source. And so I wanted Mother Nature's sources to eat on a daily basis, and that's what this company is about.
And, Michael, if people want to find you, why don't you give your phone number and email and website again? I think make sure everybody has a pen and pencil and so they'll know how to get more information. And what if they don't know what they need? I know your consultants there will work with them, and that you are available for
private consultations. Yes.
Right. So
that's right.
Let's give that information before we run out of time here or forget to do it, because I think that's important.
Okay. So once again, I'll mention the website. It's Vitality, herbs, plural, A-N-D, for and, clay.com, vitalityherbsandclay.com. Office number 541-482-9633, 541-482-9633. So feel free. You can talk to Julie. Sometimes Julie's not around. Barbara will be available. If you want, if you have very specific health conditions, then it's better to go, you know, right to me as a consultation. Those are paid consultations. Just so you know, I want, if you go to the website, the first article to read is on the homepage called The Truth About Building Physical Health. And in there, you will learn our philosophy. And it will state, first of all, there isn't an herb, a clay, a vitamin or mineral, or any other substance, natural or otherwise, that will heal or cure the human body because such things are impossible. And I state that very clearly because I know that clays and herbs do not, in and of themselves, heal the body. But what the body does is you consume it or you put it on your body interacts with it. And it will take pieces of it. It will break it apart. It will draw pieces of it into a matrix where it can combine with other nutrients that it already has resident within the body. It will form brand new metabolic compounds that could be its own medicine. It could be its own nutrition. It could form into amino acids or proteins. But it's going to take what you feed it and alter it into what it knows it needs best. So what happens is the body, in its wisdom, will heal itself with the nutrition that you provide it. And so Mother Nature knows best what kind of nutrition the body needs. So we trust nature, we question science. And so we consume natural stuff made by nature because it's comprehensive, it's multidimensional, electromagnetic in the proper ways. And so that goes into your body knows exactly what to do with it. It's not unnatural, it's not an extract, it's not a concentrate, it's not a chemical, it's real, and it's multidimensional. And it goes in your body changes it according to its needs, and then it goes and delivers it where it needs to go, and in that way, the body heals itself. So that's the way the company is built. And so this is not just a CYA statement. It is a fact that herbs and clays and natural things or unnatural things don't heal the human body. That's not possible because the body always changes them. And so we need to understand that. So when you come to and ask about what do I do for XXX condition, we're going to say to you, we don't do anything for that condition because we know that those conditions don't exist. What you have are caused by only six things. There are only six causes of all physical imbalance in the world, physical health problems we're talking here. And it could probably get into political problems, too, if you really want to stretch it that way and look long. But here's the six. And this is an important consideration. There are only six reasons why the body gets out of balance. One of them is toxicity. That's kind of obvious, right? You throw some radiation in the body, it's going to get burned. It's going to feel bad. So something's going to happen. Talking about that, I read an interview by an autopsy doctor. That's all he did. Thousands and thousands of autopsies. And he did a lot of them, thousands of, you know, dead cancer clients, patients, not his. Notice that none of them died of cancer. None. Not one died of cancer. But the vast majority, they died of two primary causes. One, radiation burn. And two, toxicity from the medicines, chemo. Think about that. Okay, so bottom line is that we have a situation where we have to we don't treat a condition because it's not caused by what they say it is. What causes it, it could be toxicity or several of these. It could be a malnourishment. So that's why we have superfoods to, not in the vegetable form, but in the seaweed, algae, strong herbal nettles, alfalfa, that kind of thing, strong herbal nutritives we have, and clays. So these, we highly nourish the body. We maximize the nutrition to provide building blocks for the body to select from to create its own food and medicine. So then we have build system strength. We build system strength. Well, what systems? Digestive system, the lymphatic system, the intestinal system, the immune system, circulatory system. We build strength. Well, how do you do that? You nourish the body with things that nourish those systems. We know that certain herbs nourish the splenic system, as an example, and help to give it what it needs in order to restore itself. And so you look at any system that's weak. And usually systems are weak because of the other reasons, malnourishment, toxicity, lifestyle stress, food combining problems, etc. So the fourth thing we have to do is not only build the systems, but we have to change the diet. And this is one of the hardest areas for most people because most people on this call believe they're actually on a very good health food diet. I hear this all the time, and I thought I was too, but I wasn't doing as well as I could be. And I was seeing I was having to take lots of herbs just to balance out my diet until I began to understand food combining and how one of the biggest problems that we have in our dietary world, partly and probably primarily because we, most of us all have had antibiotics, or most of us all are toxic enough to not have enough friendly bacteria in the body and to not have an alkaline body and to not have a flowing bile system, bile from the liver, which digests our fats. If you don't have digested fats, then you end up with fat in the blood. When you get fat in the blood, you get high sugar levels because sugar can't be found by the insulin. The fat is in the way, the oils and fat. So it causes insulin resistance. Therefore, you get high sugar levels. What happens when the body's trying to save its life, it will send, and it can't do the normal thing, which in this case would be insulin, bringing the sugar back down to store it. It sends fungus, yeast, candida, after it. That's to save your life. It's not the bad guy. It's there because it's being fed, because its job is to eat down high sugar levels. Its job is to eat up undigested food. It isn't getting digested because you don't have enough probiotics in the gut because the antibiotic killed them all. See, so, or maybe you don't have enough bile because the body's too acidic from the sugars or something. You have to change the diet. And on our website, I have an article called, Okay, So What Foods Can I Eat? And it's listed on the right-hand column of all the web pages. You'll see a link to that. And there's three or four articles there. I highly recommend you reading all of those articles because they're pretty central to first articles to read. And that foods article talks about these food combining rules. And there are some of them are fairly surprising. Like, how many health foodists get sick on eating nuts? A lot of them. I hear it all the time. And I used to get sick on eating nuts. Why is that? Because the nuts are out of the shell for a very long time. They're already rancid because they're hard to digest, because our digestive systems aren't strong enough. For lots of reasons, nuts are making a lot of people sick. They're causing tooth inflammations. So one of the primary causes of tooth inflammations is the consumption of nuts. High fungal overgrowth, acidity in the gut, hard to digest. Somehow it feeds back to the teeth. There's a lot of other causes too, sugar obviously. So you have to learn these rules all over again. What used to be called a health food may not be anymore. You know, you put a fruit and a nut together, you think like a trail mix, you could be in some serious fungal overgrowth problem by the next morning. And it could go on for 3 more weeks if you don't know how to turn it around. So you just don't eat raisins and nuts together. Things like that. So you need to know food combining rules, and you know how to handle a diet and how to work with all the challenges that we're faced in our natural health food world. You just can't get the best out of a health food store, generally speaking. So then, okay, those are the main four causes of imbalances in the human body. None of those are disease terms, none of them. I mean, they precipitate symptoms that have been labeled as such, but that isn't the cause. The cause is the toxicity, the malnourishment, the weakened systems, the bad diet. But there are two more causes that are a lot more difficult for people to, you know, work with, more challenging, because you got to stay present for one thing, and secondly, it means probably a lot more money. And one of them is called attitudes and beliefs. So if we have very extremely limited attitudes or fearful attitudes, we're going to select things and attract things that are less good for us, and they're going to have its impact on the physical body. So higher stress loads because we're in fear, higher stress loads because we make bad decisions, or we're not, we had some bad food and we're not making a clear decision. So you have to understand that attitudes and beliefs do impact the health in a great way. And so to correct that means inner healing. To heal inwardly is to not bliss out in meditation and just kind of, you know, do the spiritual whirly thing. You want to focus in on the issue at hand and look at it with an open heart rather than a closed heart, without judging your pain, your misery, your memory, but look at it and give 100% loving presence to it. And we talked about that as the inner healing method last time. And so if you can identify that date and want to go back to that, that gives you a very clear indicator as to how to quickly transform any issue in life that bothers you right now. And 1 or 2 minutes, you can start seeing results. But by giving loving presence to it is the very first order of business. And then breathing deeply, if that's all you do, you can heal a lot just doing those two things. So inner healing is very important. It's crucial. And since that's something that goes on throughout an entire life and on into other lives, depending on how much you're able and willing to forgive yourself of, for really is the bottom line, not others, but yourself, and then that determines how many more lives you have to do the inner healing work with, etc. But bottom line is, that's an important part of health. If you have certain beliefs that are driving you toward comfort foods, as an example, because, you know, things aren't working well in your life, then that's going to drive you into sugar, and that's going to be a contributing cause to your health demise, as an example. So the last sixth most important change is the most difficult for most of us, myself included. And hopefully that will be resolved here for all of us in time. But basically it means lifestyle changes. The lifestyle, and I'm going to share with you a very brief picture, partly inspired by the Anastasia materials, ringingcedars.com, if you're not familiar with it, ringingcedars.com, Anastasia books, there's I think 9 of them. And it's basically saying that if you just take a couple of acres and you plant them a certain way with, you know, a quarter or more forest and a pond and a garden and a house and a living fence surrounding it of, you know, berries and bushes and trees and so forth, then and then you plant several hundred species of plants on the inside, many of which produce food for you, you'll have a totally self-sustaining environment, and you'll be fed completely from within your own garden, and it will generally produce well over, you know, 100,000, quarter million in produce a year if you plant it right, and then it self-seeds, and you don't have to reseed it all the time. So there's very little work after you get it started, and it produces abundantly because of this microclimate that is established by that very system. So that's a lifestyle. There's a major change for most of us. Now, so, I mean, it's, you know, it's costly. You've got to buy the land. Then you got to figure out how to plant everything. You need the help and so forth. There's a lot to it. I'm not saying that's an easy one, but I'm just saying that that particular lifestyle once it gets mature and you're living 100% off your own land, it does, you know, it heals everything. You know, if your attitudes and beliefs are correspond, if you do the inner work and you work that land, the connection to the land opens up your spirit. It opens up your energy centers, your intuition, and your connection to God. And you awaken just by working with the land. And, you know, so at that point, once at some point, you will likely not need any of our products, and I look forward to that day when we all have our own piece of land and nobody needs my products. In the meanwhile, we do the best we can, and that's what these products are here for. Because very few people are going to be able to go that distance, but that land grown a certain way is the number one solution to practically every ill upon the planet, bar none. So, and the reason is because it ends the food supply problems, the homelessness problem, the spiritual battle, the religious embattlement problems, etc. Because, you know, you just wake up and you just realize how silly it is, and how that, you know, there's nothing in religion for us that, you know, God is nature in there. So you start to wake up and you get back to source. So I'm just saying that there is a phenomenal event that happens when you just simply grow a garden. So what have I done in my own environment to try to move in that direction? 1 year, I spent about a year and a half ago we moved in, and just in time to start prepare, building dirt. I was basically grew dirt for almost a solid year until the spring, and then I started building garden beds and started and then planted. So I built maybe 12 or more garden beds. They're raised beds. They're 2 feet deep in most cases, and some less, and they're fairly large, but I grew the dirt in the garden. I grew my compost piles directly in the garden. So I threw all my kitchen scraps and my straw. I was getting bales and bales of straw. I was getting coffee grounds from the local organic shops. And I was building, layering this up and cultivating the worms and the soldier fly larvae, which are phenomenal for eating down fresh produce very fast. And so I had all these big piles, 8 feet long, 6 feet wide, 2-3 feet tall, in my garden where the bed was going to be next year, or, you know, in the spring. And so once the time came to start building the bed, I just, you know, cut the square that I, the way I wanted it out of that big pile of dirt that was now well composted, leveled it off, added some fresher compost and more worm castings and straw, etc., a lot of coconut fiber, and no bark. Get rid of the bark. Get the bark out of your garden 100%. Just get rid of it. Get it out of your soil. Get it out of all the top of your garden. Get it out of the garden completely if you want good quality disease-free produce. Got to get rid of the bark. That was my biggest lesson. So if you want to garden, get rid of the bark. Use the leaves, but get rid of the bark. And so I did that, and the beds that I did that, I got excellent produce. We've already harvested 430 pounds plus a boatload of garlic this year, and we planted late because I was slow getting my beds built. And so we still have some of the heaviest produce yet in the garden, squashes and pumpkins and so forth. So I'm just saying that it was the best garden I ever had. We've harvested I think 130 pounds of tomatoes alone this year, and we still got a lot left. So it works if it's done a certain way. And in due course, I'll be posting the pictures of this experiment and what I learned from it when I've got time to really put all those pictures on there and talk about it. But I'm just saying that there was, not only does it feed us with massive amounts of produce, but it's, and this is only 1,000 square feet, by the way. Okay, so this is not a big garden. It's like a 20 by 50, right? So it's, but not only does it feed us food, but there is a nurturing of the soul just by walking out there. Just like, I've got to walk out there morning and night just to feel connected. and there's this ambiance because you put so much love into a garden, it feeds you back with love. So there's tremendous power in just doing that. And then just getting your hands in the soil is so relaxing. It's like the grounding thing that some people are talking about nowadays, just walking on the earth barefoot. Well, you put your hands in the soil, you work with those plants, work with the worm castings, and you get, it's just like there's some sedating, relaxing, uplifting kind of thing that happens, as most of you who have gardens know. So, anyway, those six areas are the cure for all conditions, including some of the spiritual ones, if you're willing to do the inner work to the nth degree. So that's the philosophy you'll find on the website, vitalityherbsandclay.com. The number is 541-482-9633. Feel free. You can talk to Julie anytime you want. You can talk to Barbara if she's available. If you want to get really nitty-gritty, if you want me to build a health program for you, that we need to do, or if you want an intuitive consultation, because I can look at all the organs and glands, we can take a look at, you know, original cause, we can do inner healing, we can do physical stuff, issues, organs and glands, whatever, and build diets as you need. And that's a paid consultation, so just talk to Julie about setting one of those up, and we can record it, and you can keep that download. So,
well, thank you, Michael. This has been very informative, and as always, we really appreciate your wisdom and your insights, and most of all, your love for humanity that allows you to just keep exploring and exploring. So we thank you for being here, and we look forward to seeing you the next time.
Okay. I look forward to it myself. Thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
All right. Well, we will take our musical break, and then when we come back, Tara and Rama have, I think you said you had a half hour that you wanted to play, and whatever else that you come up with. So, music maestro, please. Welcome back, everyone, to the last segment of our Stargate Roundtable. We're happy to have all of you stay with us here and see what Tara and Rama have in store for us tonight. So I pass the talking stick, and let's see. I assume it's going to be Tara speaking most, since Rama has a little challenge with his voice.
Well... yes, it'll be not me or Rama talking too much, but we're going to play a half hour of this special Conversations with Great Minds, and then we're going to do another, half hour of Nassim Haramein. So
okay.
We'll leave the talking up to these wise ones.
All right.
And everybody, it's really a challenge. There's a whole lot of things on everybody's minds right now. And, we think like, whose idea was it just to don't worry, be happy? This is really a trip, right? It's raising my eyebrows. I don't like that idea of the United States sending warships into South China Sea. That doesn't sound too good to me. And Russia's doing what they're doing, and our naughty children are plotting and planning much. So, all right. So we all will take care of ourselves, and we're going to just change the format here right now. We're going to change the furniture. Okay, here we go.
Okay. Change the furniture. change impact international and national security. We have an advisory board of senior military leaders as well as foreign policy analysts that look at this not primarily as an environmental issue, but rather as a national security issue. And I think that's definitely relevant to the case of Syria. So tell us the story of Syria. So in Syria, first of all, I think it's important to note that Syria, the civil war in Syria, was not caused by climate change. And definitely the refugee crisis that we're seeing now is not caused by climate change. The current refugee crisis is a result of a breakdown in government and a civil war in the country. And that's what's driving so many people out of the country. But the climate change has played a role in the country. From 2006 to 2011, the country experienced one of the worst droughts in its recorded history. We saw a couple studies back in 2011 and more recently in 2015 that have connected that particular drought to climate change. For example, a recent study showed that extreme of a drought was made 2 to 3 times more likely because of climate change. NOAA in 2011 showed that from 1971 to 2010, Syria has experienced some of the most dramatic precipitation decline as a result of climate change. So that's the climate factor. Now, that particular drought, coupled with natural resource mismanagement by the Assad regime, for example, the Assad regime is heavily subsidizing cotton farming, which is water intensive, and also trying to produce its own wheat, which is very water intensive. Those kinds of dynamics and some demographic pressures really depleted the water table and led to the devastation of about 75% of cropland in the country, especially in the Northeast. That's 75% of crops completely decimated. So that's 75% of farmers, particularly in the Northeast, who had to essentially leave. Most of those people moved into urban areas. And then you also had about 85% of livestock amongst herders that were decimated. A number of those people had to move. Roughly 2 million people in a UN report back in 2011 had to find somewhere to go, literally had no livelihood. And so a lot of those people moved into places like Damascus and Homs, which really weren't prepared for that internal mass migration. We're already dealing with refugee flows from Iraq, refugee flows from Palestine, for example. And also we're dealing with water infrastructure deficiencies. So you had about 60% of the water in Damascus being wasted just because of infrastructure deficiency. So you had leakage, things like that. Exactly. So this was happening. But the interesting thing was that most political analysts, security analysts, including intelligence agencies, were not looking at Syria as a country that was perceived to be stable. And so Syria was labeled as potentially immune to the Arab Spring, in comparison to Egypt and Tunisia. But when you look at the analysis of what makes a country sort of devolve into political turmoil, you look at things like state fragility indices. These are things that foreign policy people and people in the intelligence world look at to figure out whether or not a country is going to fall apart. Environmental stresses, climatic stresses, natural resource stresses are usually not on the top of the list of sort of concerns. So I think it's important to look at what impact did that mass displacement have on the conflict in Syria, and what impact did climate change have on the conflict in Syria? And again, it's a very complex issue. I'd say the al-Assad regime is don't want to absolve governments of failures to provide for their people. I would say the al-Assad regime is complicit in not being able to manage its natural resources in the face of climatic change. But climate change is part of the picture, so we need to think about that. We need to think about it in particular when we're looking at solutions for the future, post-conflict Syria.
So we had this massive drought in Syria that drove the farmers into the cities. There's a storyline that I think many people have heard that really the uprising in Syria, sort of like the Tunisian one, started with a street vendor who set himself on fire.
Right.
That the one in Syria started in
Daraa.
Yeah, thank you. With some kid scrawling graffiti on the wall that basically said, we want to take down the government, or we want to replace the government, and that the government responded with gunfire and started killing people, which apparently they did. And But that's really not the story. That is the symptom of the story, isn't it?
I think that's about right. I mean, I think it's part of the story. It's about the difference between proximate and ultimate causes. And I think in this particular case, in Daraa, you had protesters who were upset with the Assad regime, and the Assad regime responded in a brutal way, and that was the proximate cause, I think, of the revolutionary movement in the country, you know, sort of getting started. I think that was the moment. However, under the surface, there were these other pressures, as I was talking about before. And it's worth noting that Daraa is essentially a farming town. And it's also worth noting that the Syrian opposition movement that built up in 2011 and going into 2012 and up until now has been a much more rural opposition movement, or at least you've had rural forces that have been much more involved in this opposition movement than you saw, say, for example, in Egypt and in Tunisia. And of course, there are ethnic, sectarian reasons for that. You know, there were differences between the Alawite, you know, Assad regime and different ethnic groups that felt they weren't being treated fairly. We even saw that with water resources, for example. There was some evidence that the Assad regime was awarding well drilling contracts along sectarian lines, things of that sort. So there's a justice problem. So it's very complex. But the conditions were there for revolution, and some of those conditions were environmental, were about food, were about water, and it's just something that we haven't taken seriously enough yet. But it is something that that more than just environmentalists are worried about. I mean, this is something that the U.S. military, going back to the Bush 2 administration back in 2003, was worried about. The impacts of climate change on security in strategically significant regions and internationally. And so this is not a partisan issue. Climate change interacts with our security landscape, interacts with other drivers of instability and conflict. And we just need to take a clear-headed look at it and figure out what to do to make sure that these security breakdowns don't happen in the future or aren't made more likely by climate change in the future, because what we're really talking about is likelihood and conflict being more likely as a result of these stresses.
Here in the United States back in the 1930s, we had the Dust Bowl, and it was largely precipitated by bad agricultural practices, you know, cutting, deforestation, all these other things. But it was also, apparently, there was regional drought that were associated with that. How do we know that what happened in Syria is not just sort of a repeat of the Dust Bowl, just a periodic, possibly cyclical drought, and it collided with an explosive political climate and and the change in the Assad government when his dad died a couple of years back, and he wasn't as sophisticated, I'd say, as his father, perhaps as a politician, and so I can't imagine his father shooting people, but his father was pretty despotic too, but. How do you know it's climate change and not just one of those things?
It's an important question. We know in this particular case because of the science. So we look at this 2011 report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which shows clear evidence that from 1971 to 2010, the precipitation decline in the region in the winter, when the region gets most of its water, has been very dramatic, and that decline is specifically tied to climatic changes. And so would be much more unlikely if it wasn't for climate change and the amount of greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere. So that's one piece of evidence. And then in 2015, Colin Kelly and his colleagues put out a study showing that the specific drought from 2007-2010 was made 2 to 3 times more likely because of climate change. So there are sort of two points of evidence that we're really seeing something unprecedented in the region. Yes, it's an arid region. Yes, it's experienced drought out in the past, but the extremity of this drought, the worst in Syria's recorded history, was made much more likely because of climate change. So we know that. However, it's important to note that it wasn't just climate change that helped deplete the water table in Syria, that devastated cropland and rangeland for livestock. It's also bad agricultural practices. For example, you mentioned that in the context of the Dust Bowl. That was happening in Syria as well. In particular, Assad really wanted to grow wheat in the country, unlike a lot of Middle Eastern countries. So most Middle Eastern countries dependent on the global wheat market. Assad said, well, we're going to do it here. Of course, some dependence on the global market, but was insistent on growing wheat. Wheat takes a lot of water. Was insistent on growing a lot of cotton, which is a cash crop. That takes up a lot of water. And also uses, for example, irrigation techniques or encourages irrigation techniques like flood irrigation, where you waste about 60% of the water you use in agriculture. Mm-hmm. You put the drought on top of that, a drought made worse by climate change. You put the dynamics of the Arab Spring, demographic dynamics, political dynamics, the loss of fear amongst populations, the loss of fear of their governments, the sense of hope that they can change their governments. You put all that together and you have the situation in Syria. So I think that's really important to note. It's not just climate change. Climate change is what in the military is called a threat multiplier or a risk multiplier or an accelerant of instability. It's something that can drive political instability or other kinds of instability or really just make it worse. And so I think that's really important because we don't want to absolve, I think, governments and societies necessarily of responsibility for these kinds of things. It's very easy to say, to point to an external actor. And in this case, well, it was climate change. It wasn't our government policies. That's not the case in terms of the Assad regime. So that, I think, is important to think about complexity. But climate change has certainly played a role, and we need to think about that.
Yeah. In the little less than a minute we have before the break, this is happening all over the region, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, the entire region is facing a significant precipitation decline. And what's scary is when you look at observable records, so you see what precipitation decline has already happened, that matches up with previous climate models. And when we look at 10, 20, 30 years going forward, the region is going to experience a lot more precipitation decline. So that's a difficult thing. It's already a volatile region. There's already a lot of political instability, economic and social disaffection in the region. When you add climate change on top of that, that makes things a lot more difficult.
It becomes really, really wild.
That's right.
More of tonight's Conversations with Great Minds with Francesco Femia right after the break. Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with Francesco Femia, co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Security. I keep retitling you.
It's okay.
Sorry. Journalist Naomi Klein has said that climate change changes everything. You've kind of laid out what that means for Syria. Are there now, literally like farmhouses and farming communities all over parts of Syria that used to be fertile and green that are now just completely abandoned? Is the sand coming and encroaching? Is the desert expanding? What does it look like there? And is there any hope for it to cycle back to a less severe time, number one? Mm-hmm. And number two, well, we'll get to number two after that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening is there's a new normal, and that's in the case of the Middle East, in the case of Syria, that means for the foreseeable future, that's less water in the winter, and that's something that the region's going to have to face. There's enough climate change baked into the atmosphere to drive that for centuries, basically, and so we're not likely to go
centuries,
back.
Not
yeah.
Decades. Not.
No, I mean, and if something isn't done, we're looking at, longer than that. And so so we're looking at just a drier region. And that does mean that it's going to be much more difficult to farm. It's going to be much more difficult to raise livestock and to herd livestock in rangeland. And it's compounded by demographic pressures. So desertification doesn't happen just because of natural processes. You can overgraze land, you can mismanage land, and that helps drive that kind of process. And then, of course, you have a conflict in Syria, so it's hard to really predict anything at this point until the conflict subsides. But the thing is, it's really difficult to sort of predict a lot of different kinds of political and security dynamics in any country. But we actually have a higher degree of certainty about what the region's water situation is going to be
you like, in terms of precipitation, in terms of climate, than we do about other security issues. So we can actually start planning for this kind of issue right now in a way that we can't for sort of other some other dynamics. And so I think it's worth, it's easy to get pretty doom and gloom about this, but there are a lot of things that the international community can do, but also governments in the region can do to help to try to mitigate these stresses from both a mitigation and adaptation, climate adaptation perspective.
Wouldn't one of the first things be to slow down the rate at which climate change is happening by getting the world off carbon?
Yeah, I mean, I think the U.S. military would call that a risk mitigation strategy. I mean, if we continue with the amount of climate change we're seeing, then we're going to see greater risks in the future in the security landscape. And so that is a natural outgrowth of that, is to do something about it and to stop the rate of change.
How is it that the kind of political branch of American politics, the part of American politics that is so gung-ho about the military, mm-hmm. are largely universally denying climate change even happens, and yet the Pentagon is right on top of this stuff?
Yeah.
To what extent, A, is the Pentagon into this, planning for this, including this in their future scenarios, and B, why is it that Americans don't know this?
Yeah, so the U.S. military has been, and the intelligence community, has been looking at this issue, not superficially, but very seriously, since the beginning of the George W. Bush 2 administration. So this was a Republican administration in the Department of Defense under that administration looked at the issue, put out a report. The Office of Net Assessments, a very conservative institution, put out a report on the potential abrupt impacts of climate change and what that might mean for national security, and registered some very serious concerns. During the tail end of the Bush administration, we saw the Navy start to set up a U.S. Navy task force climate change because it saw the issue. The intelligence community, starting in 2007, again during the Bush administration, put out assessments showing that climate change was likely to have significant implications for national and international security. So they're looking at it, and not just looking at it, planning for it, trying to come up with contingencies for how to deal with it, et cetera. Now, I think that hasn't yet translated to the American public fully because sort of solutions that have been deemed ideological, solutions to greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera, have sort of driven the conversation about the problem itself. And we've seen sort of loud voices on the right and also loud voices on the left sort of dominate the conversation. And in that context, you haven't really seen the security community voice on this. And so I think that's part of it. And part of it is that the security community, the military, is naturally not very vocal about these sorts of things. So they'll put out reports. They'll sort of integrate these kinds of issues in their strategic planning, in their guidance to the combatant commands, for example. But it's not something they're on RT America talking about,
or
CNN for that matter. And so I think that's part of the problem. And so I think the media definitely plays a role in highlighting the security perspective.
Yeah, and or failing to. Arguably. There just seems to be a general unwillingness to get into climate change issues these days with the media because it's been so, quote, politicized. And it seems like that's just been the consequence of, oil billionaires and large oil companies that are really leaning on them. We talked a little bit about the region. There was this narrative over the last 4 or 5 years that democracy was breaking out. That it started in Tunisia, that Egypt, that it's spreading across the region, and then it got to Syria, and all this happened, depending on who you talk to, because President Obama gave an uplifting speech, went to Egypt and said, hey, why don't you overthrow your government? Or because President Obama failed to lead somehow, I've heard the people blaming Obama for the Arab Spring or it going wrong. To what extent is that whole phenomena that we refer to as the Arab Spring, or that we're now referring to as like this mess in the region, being driven by climate change?
It's a great question. It's a difficult one to answer. I'd start by saying demographic pressures, including the famous youth bulge in the region, and economic sort of discontent amongst populations in Egypt and in Tunisia and also in Syria, are definitely sort of key drivers of the Arab Spring, and it is important.
and also a desire for voice in a democratic system of some kind. So I think those are key drivers. However, underneath the sort of the surface, the political and economic surface, there are some key key environmental drivers of concern in the region, and climate change is one of those things. So, for example, we were talking before about precipitation decline in the region. There's also been sort of shocks outside of the Middle East and North Africa related to climate change that have directly affected, for example, food prices in Egypt and Tunisia. In 2010, there was a major drought / heat wave in Russia and China. China, for example, purchased a ton of wheat off the global market. That, along with some other factors, drove prices of wheat up about 300% in Egypt. So the price of bread was up 300% in Egypt. The Egyptian government, put some subsidies in to try to lower that price. But outside urban areas, there's a lot of corruption in that system. The price of bread was 300%. And so while the Mubarak regime was accusing the protesters in Tahrir Square of being sort of your urban elites, Western educated elites, there were farmers in about three different places across Egypt who were protesting about the price of wheat. And that was directly related to a decision China made, which was directly related to a climatic shock, which has been connected to climate change. So that's something that sort of may have broadened the appeal of the revolutionary movement in Egypt. So it's a contributing factor. I don't think we have enough evidence to say it's the contributing factor, but it's certainly a contributing factor in the stresses on people's lives. And again, it's not disconnected from economic and political grievances. Climate change changes everything. Climate change impacts economic well-being very directly. And so it's sort of one of those issues that is hard to separate out. It really sort of influences the whole environment in a country.
Back when the price of wheat had spiked, we had, I think it was Matt Taibbi was on the program, mm-hmm. talking about how Goldman Sachs had set up a commodities exchange, and mm-hmm. they were basically manipulating wheat prices, among other commodities. Is the international, the active activities of international banksters and whatnot, is that a variable in this, or is that a peripheral issue?
There are a lot of inputs into what causes global food markets to move in different ways, right. and that may be one of them. Yeah. But in this particular case of bread price, drought in China really did have a significant impact on their harvest.
Right. And that drought was climate change connected?
That particular drought, yeah, 2010, there are a couple studies, and that also affected Russia. There were major heat waves as well in Russia and Ukraine that also affected some of the wheat harvest in Russia as well. Two different studies, corroborating studies, showed that drought was much more likely because of climate change, 80% more likely because of climatic change.
Are we looking in California here in the United States right now? It's just insanely dry. I think they're at 5% of traditional snowpack capacity or something like that. What is climate change doing to the United States?
Well, climate change is affecting the globe, and it's not just fragile nations that are affected. We look at, for example, even in the case of Syria. Syria wasn't really thought of as a fragile nation, but it became one very quickly. So there are some fragilities that we have to deal with, even as developed countries. And in the Western United States, there's a lot of evidence. You can see it in the recent IPCC Fifth Assessment Report, et cetera, that the drought conditions that California experienced are very likely to be related to climate change. And so I think that's something we have to deal with and figure out. And so we're seeing unprecedented drought on the West Coast, but in the Southwest as well. And this is a big deal, and it's a big deal for us domestically, for domestic infrastructure. We've also seen some serious issues along these lines, and that have driven wildfires, for example, in Alaska, which also directly impacts sort of our military equities. If we want to talk about sort of security concerns around this, you have Army training sites that are affected by wildfires. And peat in Alaska, for example, so the military can't conduct its exercises. So it's basically, it's affecting our populations, it's affecting our military, it's affecting all sectors of society. And so that's why we can't treat it just as an environmental issue. This is sort of, it's an environmental issue, it's an economic issue, it's a political issue, it's a security issue, et cetera.
And the security aspect of it seems to be so underreported, underestimated, under discussed. Francesco, you're doing great work.
you and the organization. It's marvelous to have you with us.
Thanks for having me
here, Tom. Joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Pleasure to meet you. Francisco Femia. To see this and other Conversations with Great Minds, go to our website at conversationswithgreatminds.com. And that's the way it is tonight, Thursday, October 8th, 2015. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there and get active. Tag your it.
Okay, now we're going to switch channels. That was pretty strong. We got a good assessment of that case. Hope that was insightful for you, everyone. Okay. All right, now let's continue. This is from last time. We're going to continue where we have left off. You'll recognize this. Here we go with Nassim.
Ten tetrahedron on the bottom. This is called four frequencies of trophic vector matrix. So 10 tetrahedrons on the bottom, three in the middle. Six in the middle, three on top, and then one, making a huge tetrahedron on its own. Can everybody see this? So there's actually 20 tetrahedron in an isotropic vector matrix. And if you take only one face of the isotropic vector matrix, just a plane of it, then you have four faces on the bottom, three faces on the second level, two faces on the third level, and one face on top. Everybody sees this? Okay. Well, when I found the isotropic vector matrix, I thought, well, I'm interested about negative space. So let me take off the tetrahedrons and see what's in between them. So I did that, and when I did that, I realized what was in between the tetrahedrons. They're octahedrons. Do I have a little octahedron somewhere? Oh, I know. I guess it have destroyed the glue while I was traveling, melted with this 108 degree heat we've been having. So I lost some of my models. But an octahedron is a pyramid with another one below it. Emphasis on the word pyramid. So I was happy to find that the pyramidal geometry was present between the tetrahedrons. Can everybody see how an octahedron is two pyramids base to base? If this is one point of the pyramid, then the base is here. And it's a square base, looks rectangular because it's in perspective. And the other point is here, right? Two pyramids base to base. There is a bunch of them together. But when I did this, I realized there was something weird. There was something weird in the middle of the metric. Because the metric is called isotropic. So you would expect that it would be always in balance, that it would always be in symmetry. But there was a symmetry in the middle. I found four reverse tetrahedron pointing down and rotated 180 degrees. Mm-hmm. And they didn't belong to the octahedron. And they didn't belong to the tetrahedrons that made up the outside or the metric. So there was a bunch of these, there was four of these tetrahedrons completely out of place, creating a symmetry in the middle of symmetry. Now I knew this had to be incomplete. Because if this was the fundamental structure of the vacuum, it had to be isotropic and symmetry so that you would have perfect equilibrium. Oh, there's an octahedron. Thank you. Ooh, nice. Q-tips. Thank you. Appreciate. Q-tips with what?
Rubber
honey?
Cement. Rubber cement.
Rubber cement. Here's an octahedron. And so when, that wouldn't melt as well. Oh, that's good. Because I used to do it with marshmallows, but then people would grab the marshmallows and eat them. And I'd lose my mind. But anyway, so the isotropic vector metric had to be modified. I didn't know how. One thing I was sure of is that the universe is polarized, so that it had to be two. Okay? Now, if you have a polarized universe and you have two isotropic vector metrics and they're mirroring each other, you have a problem. Because the two mirroring each other base to base don't make a sphere. Remember, fundamental axiom, the universe is generating spheres, right? So you don't have a sphere, you have an egg. And so now I had a chicken and an egg problem. And I was like, oh my God, what do I do with this? I didn't know what to do. But I knew it had to be two isotropic vector metrics. I didn't know what to do with these other spaces, these other tetrahedrons in the middle, neither. And you got to realize that at that point in my evolution now, I'm finishing my ski career. I got a bunch of universal 2x4s behind the head, forcing me out, telling me, you got to do this full time. You ain't going to do this while teaching skiing. And I'm still doing all this without a computer. So I'm rendering these geometries in my head, and I'm trying to figure out how they fit together. Okay, I found the octahedrons in the middle and all this. And then I'm going, okay, wait a minute. I got to make this become a sphere. But I don't want to distort the geometry of the isotropic vector metric. It has to be tetrahedrons. So I'm like getting all frustrated about it. And I'm, okay, well, finally, I decided, okay, and I pushed one into the other. And I, you know, generated this in my brain. I was pushing one into the other and trying to figure out where the tetrahedrons would fall. And then that's when I realized what had happened. When you push one isotropic vector metric into the other so that you generate a perfect sphere, then the central geometry is a vector equilibrium, the only geometry in full equilibrium in all vectorial possibility. And there is no distortion because those four tetrahedrons that were in the isotropic vector matrix alone were there to accept the reverse one so that the one isotropic vector matrix was missing its better half. And when the two came together, it created equilibrium. I still get the chills from that time when I discovered this. It was like, oh my God, this is beautifully metaphoric and beautiful for what I'm trying to achieve, the geometry of equilibrium, the geometry of the vacuum. And I could see how the male and the females coming together generates a new point of center, a new being. Boy, that, you know, at that point, I was living in my van. I had sold everything, all my ski equipment, all my stuff. I moved into a van so I could sponsor my research. I moved down south so I wouldn't have to eat so much. And so I was doing this in my van, and I was, you know, I was so excited. I mean, this was better than sex. I mean, I didn't have a girlfriend at the time, you know? And so it was just beautiful. It was metaphorically beautiful, but in the physics of what I was trying to achieve, it was exactly going in the direction I wanted it to go. And I realized that the vector equilibrium had to be fundamental to the structure of space, of the class. Why is the vector equilibrium the only geometry in full equilibrium in all vectorial possibility? Let me show you. If you have a vector going in one direction, and that vector has a certain length, we'll call the length of the vector its force. So longer it is, stronger it is, shorter it is, weaker it is. Okay? In order to get equilibrium, you would have to have a vector in the exact opposite direction with exactly the same length. But that's a weak equilibrium because you'd have to nail that vector so that it would be a perfect alignment here. Otherwise, you would miss equilibrium. And any forces pushing down in any other direction would break the equilibrium. It's very precarious. So how would you increase stability? You'd probably add vectors at 90 degree angle from those. Now you increase equilibrium, right? However, the edge of your geometry has longer vectors than the vectors to the center. Because they're longer, they're stronger, and thus you're more. What would you do to try to correct it? Probably add vectors at 45 degree angles from these other ones. But if you did that, then the edge vectors are shorter than the vectors to the center. The geometry implodes. You still don't have equilibrium. So what's the solution? The solution is the hexagon. Because the hexagon has edge vectors that are the exact same length as the vectors to the center. It's the only geometry that does that. So now you have equilibrium. And what does that look like in 3D? It looks like a vector equilibrium. This geometry here. Vector equilibrium. It's 8 tetrahedrons pointing inwards. Now, this can be seen as well as 4 hexagons intersecting each other. Do you see that? The red one on the edge, there's a blue one at the equator, and then 2 ones intersecting in the middle. Everybody see that? There's a red one on the edge, an hexagon on the edge. 4 hexagons intersecting, creating equilibrium at the center or singularity. And note that there is 12 vectors radiating from the vector equilibrium. So there's 12 vectors radiating from the center, and there's 12 edge vectors, 24 vectors. These numbers are found in most ancient civilization texts. 12, 24, and so on are found everywhere. The 12 angels with singularity in the middle, the 12 apostles with Emmanuel in the middle, the singularity, you know, and so on. The 24 elders in Kabbalistic traditions, and so on. So I was really amazed that I had found this, but my geometry was still out of equilibrium. Meaning, on this geometry of the two isotropic vector matrix, the vector equilibrium in the middle had all of its octahedron filled. That means that when the vector equilibrium is in the middle, the pyramidal structure
is not similar. Just a second. Hello, everybody. Dougie gave us about 10 more minutes, so we're going to just go a little bit more with Nassim. Yeah, that's good, right there. Okay, we're going to continue a little bit more with Nassim, and then we'll say goodbye. Solar flares or something. Here we go.
So it's asymmetric. So I decided I have to keep adding tetrahedron till I gain symmetry. So I kept on adding tetrahedron, and to cover all of the faces, I had to add 24 tetrahedrons to the ones that were already there. So this is one isotropic vector matrix is 20. The other one is 20, that's 40, plus 24. 40 plus 24 was 64 tetrahedron matrix. The 64 tetrahedron matrix is a match to many, many things. I'm going to give you a hint. There is 64 codons that generate the 20 amino acids of your DNA structure. Now, when I found the 64 tetrahedron grid, then I realized that that was the quanta in which symmetry was present everywhere and equilibrium was truly generated at the center. But what got me really excited is that I realized what I had built. What I had built was a fractal structure, just like the 2D fractal structure I showed you at the beginning, but this one in full 3D spherical coordinates. The only true fractal 3D spherical coordinate that you will find. Can everybody see the vector equilibrium on the inside? And then the vector equilibrium on the outside, this continues to grow to infinity. And I could see that the inside vector equilibrium, its radius is exactly half the radius of the one on the outside. So the geometry grows in fractals, but not only does it grow in fractals, the fractals are perfect octaves. You see? And so I got really excited. It's like, oh my God, here it is. The structure of the vacuum. Equilibrium to infinity. Infinitely big to infinitely small. And then I noticed further that how this was constructed is constructed this way. Let me see if I can let go of some of this stuff. Actually, I'm going to leave that. I realized what I had built. I had built a matrix based on 8 star tetrahedron, each having 8 tetrahedron in it. Okay? All coming together towards the center to generate the star, the 64 tetrahedron grid. But when it did, the 8 stars coming together, okay, here you're only going to see 6, plus the one in front, and then there's one in the back you won't see. So the 8 stars coming together generate the vector equilibrium in the middle. Why is this significant? 8-star tetrahedron is made out of 8 tetrahedron pointing upward, radiation, coming together to generate the vector equilibrium, which is 8 tetrahedron coming towards the center, generating contraction. So now, not only did I have found the geometry of equilibrium, but I had found the only fractal 3D metric, and it generated expansion and contraction. Exactly all the axioms I had placed for myself when I started this investigation of the geometry of space.
Okay, everybody. We just completed a thought, a little bit of a... Okay, and then I'm going to go to this unicorn story, and then we'll do some magic, and you put our computers, all of our computers, both ends in the circle of support. Rama's going to have a little chat with our New Mexico surf tomorrow. Okay, so this is pages 94 and 95. As this stag grazes on poppy and daisy petals, also in Greece, we are provided a fairly close view of his horn. Rudolf Springer comments on this, and Odell Shepherd says, quote, "By far the strangest thing in the history of opinion about the alicorn's appearance is the age and persistence of the belief in the natural spiral twistings, or striae. These are clearly delineated in every picture of the unicorn that I have seen in medieval manuscripts, some of which are drawn in the 12th century. It is possible that alien, A-E-L-I-A-N, meant to describe them as his phrase," and that's all in Greek, "for the word," all in Greek, "may mean either rings or spirals. It is also interesting to note that the alicorn, A-L-I-C-O-R-N, was highly regarded as an aphrodisiac, a treasured love potent. As Rudiger Robert Beer tells us, a restorative for sexual potency, and with its pronounced phalloid shape, it also is a vigorous love symbol." That's that for that one. And I'm still going to say it's amazing to me that unicorns only have pregnancies every years in their lifetimes, and that they live for thousands and thousands of years, though, and that's to this day. It's pretty amazing. And everything is changing now. It's just like the title of Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything. We're going to be in a whole new technological world, and even the old manufacturing jobs and everything that they think they're going to need. I mean, these, just like the simple 200, even Dr. Keshi has at the top of his little piece on this $200 machine that provides free energy and all the utilities are free. He says right in there that it says, "For those who cannot afford this unit, funding will be available from many, many sources all around the world." In other words, he's already set it up that everybody's going to get on this. This is going to be so astounding. Okay, so it's time to go. Plasma energy power, everybody. You know, plasma energy power. Let's get that out in the street. All right, we'll see you one and all. We are truly all one, and we live in very amazing times. And Sat Nam to everyone, and may peace prevail on all parts of the earth, and may we all be well. Inshallah, and Sat Nam, and
Sat Nam Ki.
There we go. Ahomi Takuyasin. Namaste.